now to the perspective of women and how they fared post-war. I'm joined now by Professor Kate Derrien-Smith. Kate's the chair of the history program at the University of Melbourne, and she's researched and written extensively on both life during and after the war. And Emeritus Professor Susan Sheridan from Flinders University in South Australia, while Susan was at the Women's Studies Unit, she did a research project that resulted in a terrific book, which I commend to you, looking at the Australian Women's Weekly in the post-war years. The book is called Who Was That Woman? And it was mightily helpful to us as we prepared this program. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Kate, in the general conversation about war, women tend to be left on the sidelines, as seen as the nurses or the wives or the mothers waiting at home. But during World War II, they were pretty important, really, in keeping the country turning over, working in the factories like my mother, driving the trams and the buses. It was quite a liberating time for women in a strange sense, wasn't it, in the face of war?
Yes, look, the war brought many new opportunities for women in the workforce and in public life, and opportunities to participate and learn new skills.
And women's paid work became more socially acceptable, didn't it? And it was aligned, well, in fact, government propaganda aligned it with patriotism.
Yes, that's one of the big changes, I think, so that it's seen as legitimate, important war work. And one of the big changes is the types of work that women were doing. Before the war, the largest sector for women's employment was in domestic service. Low paid, often quite low status. But the war really ended that, as women were able to move into factories and the number never returned to domestic service.
Now, Susan, the Women's Weekly is really a vital chartist of not only what Australian women were experiencing during this time, but in a way what they were also being told. You had one in four homes. The Weekly was read in one in four homes. It represented everyday Australia to itself. Was there an emphasis during the war? Was there a sort of support of women coming out of the homes, but then were they encouraged to go back to the family? Like, how would you characterise it?
Yes, I think you can. There are some wonderful issues of the Weekly during the war that praise women's patriotism in going back into the workforce and often going into occupations, as Kate mentioned, that women hadn't been actually encouraged or even allowed to undertake before. But after the war, of course, it was really assumed that those who needed to remain in the workforce would return to or stay in traditionally feminine occupations, like shop assistants or typists, but that married women certainly wouldn't be likely to be in the workforce.
I suppose what I really got from reading both your work, but particularly looking at the Weekly, that I hadn't quite grasped, is that this was really an explosive sense of women's lives changing. And it must have been a bit tricky for the Weekly, Sue, that they had to really juggle this need to be very positive and patriotic, and as you said, they recognised the heroism during the war, but then they had to somehow put Humpty back together again. I don't know. Did they do it?
This often happened in fiction stories, that women who'd experienced a new kind of independence during the war would really miss that when they had to go back home. But, of course, there was such a strong emphasis on the need to establish new families or re-establish new families. That was seen as the positive challenge for the post-war years.
Look,
women.
I'm going to come to marriage just a little bit later because it is so terribly interesting. But let's talk about a range of issues, about the huge tide of migrants who arrived in a very short time. Now, Kate, how did this affect women and society more generally?
Well, in the post-war period, really by the early 50s, you have a higher proportion of women working in paid employment than you did during the war. But it's migrant women moving in and taking a lot of those jobs. And I think it's a much more complicated picture than is sometimes presented, that women just moved into the workforce in the war and then moved out. It's a very complex labour picture. And the migrant women are there to fill those occupations that Australian-born women perhaps had moved
vacated.
Yes.
And did the Weekly give much time and attention to migrants, Sue?
No, not really. The lives of migrant families didn't really come into the Weekly's purview really until probably the early 60s.
Mm.
So a lot of what Kate's just been talking about, migrant women occupying those positions in the paid workforce, those very low paid positions, really didn't, just went under the radar.
What was interesting was the coverage of Japan, Sue. There were a series of articles about the Australian contingent of the British Commonwealth Occupation Forces in Jura and Japan. Dorothy Drain, one of the Weekly's senior reporters, went and travelled there. I thought that was quite remarkable, given what had occurred between Japan and Australia.
Yes. Well, Barbara Bedd, who did that part of our project and wrote the chapter about 1946, was immensely struck by that. And there were, weeks and weeks where the major stories were about the Australian occupation forces in Japan and what they experienced. Of course, there was no mention of Hiroshima and the aftermath
of that. Let me just tell listeners that Professor Kate Darian-Smith from the University of Melbourne and Emeritus Professor Susan Sheridan from Flinders University are joining us at this part of our special program to commemorate the 70th anniversary of victory in the Pacific. Let's go to the marriage issue, because the Women's Weekly did not tackle relationship problems all that well in a way, although you have ads that appeared in the Weekly about how to get your man to stay with you instead of going out with his old regiment, or to get rid of your BO by using a particular soap. But, in a sense, people were setting up new marriages from old marriages, weren't they? I mean, this is really quite profound. People who might have married when they were young and, that he'd gone away for war for 3 or 4 years and she'd had to raise the children on her own. We've already heard Tom Keneally talk about the fact that there was a very feminine sense in the household. And when his father came home and found his two boys reading books, he said, this is not what a man does. This is tricky, isn't it, Sue, again?
Oh, indeed, yes. There had been very strongly female-centred households, and very often intergenerational ones too, grandparents and mother and children coping and then having to reform themselves. And of course, the children, I think, often wondered who was this strange man who came into the house and lived with them. So there were the already established relationships that had to be virtually remade, as well as all the younger couples.
You did make the point, in 51 there were a series of 4 major articles about divorce in response to the fact that there'd been around 6,000 divorces in Australia in 1949. And from what I quickly read, it was a lot of desertion rather than adultery. But I'm wondering, Kate, in another book on this topic you've contributed to, it was noted that women may be empowered economically, politically and sexually, but the trauma of war could leave men emasculated. Now, is there much evidence of that post-World War II?
Look, I think there's a lot of tension between couples, and certainly some years ago I did a lot of interviews with women who'd lived during that period. They were young women during the war, and a number did talk about that readjustment post-war. They'd felt very empowered. These were women who'd been in the workforce, sometimes having to deal with husbands returning who were quite traumatised, sometimes out of place, feeling a bit out of place when the war ended. But I think it's also important to remember that a lot of young couples married very quickly during the war. It was often talked about as a sort of war craziness, that young men and women would fall in love, marry, sometimes only knowing each other for a short period. Off the man might go to serve overseas, and at the end of the war, possibly they didn't know each other particularly well. So there's a lot of issues about re-establishing family life, and really I think working out personal relations over long periods of separation.
Gosh, what an Everest to climb. I must move on to the other major issue that you, Susan, nominated, which was the big shift to the consumerist and aspirational lifestyle, targeted straight and centre, front and centre at women, the new home, the white goods. You write that it was a revolution in mass production and marketing and the social construction of a consumerist ethic of spending, including debt. So that's where it really started to surface, and women had to undo sort of generations of frugality.
Yes, exactly. And in 1946, the first year after the war, they were still being urged to save, don't spend, to maintain those habits of frugality, because indeed there was still rationing, there was food rationing and rationing of lots of things, dress materials, building materials as well. And you see this rapid change between 1946 and 5 years later, when you see the beginnings of the ethic that had to go with consumerist society. So people were being encouraged to think of higher purchase as something perfectly okay to undertake. And then there were advertisements for all the new ranges of white goods and things like that that they could aspire to have in their homes. But even then, even in the early 50s, some people were still a long way off from the ideal of having their own homes, some of those.
Yes, but they were aspiring to it. That's what's so interesting. And all of this, it just to be reminded of where this modern world began. That's how I saw it anyway.
Yes, it was extraordinary, really, to see. I mean, when you see things like supermarkets being introduced during the 50s, before that, a lot of women bought their fresh fruit and vegetables and even their groceries from deliveries from door to door. So shopping was revolutionised and goods themselves were revolutionised, and there were lots more ready-made kinds of foods that could be bought, and therefore family eating habits
changed.
And you can see all this charted out in the weekly stories.
And Kate, I want to ask you, before I ask you both for a very quick sum-up, I talked to Brendan Nelson about Australian Indigenous soldiers and how World War II had brought greater recognition of their war efforts. You have an interesting take on how Black American soldiers based in Australia had a quite inspiring effect on Aboriginal communities, bringing the beginnings of activism.
Look, I think that Americans, Afro-Americans, could provide models of men, non-white men, in active roles, in roles where they were doing important things. And certainly there's quite a lot of interaction between Black American troops and Indigenous communities in the north of Australia that really stands out. And there are also Indigenous women who go into branches of the armed service or into the land army as well. So I think that there is a shift for all sorts of different Australian communities in the war, and that's certainly one of the impacts of the American servicemen.
Mm. So just very quickly from both of you, in terms of comparing and contrasting this period with other periods in terms of changing Australian life, how would you cite it? First to you, Sue.
Through the lens of the Women's Weekly, as you pointed out, I think that that change to a consumerist society where the production of goods for domestic consumption became more and more important to the economy, and women were drawn into this and encouraged to see themselves as the one who was in charge of spending for the family, I think that gave it a new dimension to the role of housewife, which oddly enough sort of expanded the role and tried to make it look more important. And it was against that image of the central importance of the woman in the home that women began to rebel in the 60s and wanting to go back into the workforce and to play a larger role in public life.
Certainly, Kate, it's not, well, I don't think it sounds like the conservative period that is the generally accepted tone of this era.
No, look, I actually think the post-war period is a very interesting period where a lot is happening and there's big shifts. I sometimes think that the war years bring about an end to what I'd call a sort of older Australia, and then you have a move to a modern Australia, the second half of the 20th century, where you've got big changes in migration, as Sue's mentioned, in consumerism, patterns of operating in society in terms of housewife. I think real shift in gender roles. By the end of the 50s, you've got television that is having quite a major impact, economic change as well. So I think that post-war decade and a half going up to the 60s is one of quite a lot of turbulence, often cast as conservative and quiet, but I think a lot is happening. And there's a really strong vision from the government, and it is a Labor government during the Second World War, to reconstruct after the war. You know, they set up post-war reconstruction, this idea of rebuilding Australia, rebuilding the nation and the family, putting up a safety net, looking at a better future. You know, it's very optimistic. It's a very optimistic period in many ways.
Mm. It certainly is.
The thing perhaps that we forget is that when the war broke out, Australia had, like many other countries, had by no means recovered from the Depression. So there was an enormous amount, you know, that emphasis on getting ready for reconstruction when the war ended was also due to that, I think, wasn't it, Kate?
Yes, I think that's very, that great line that you've got, you know, that the Weekly presented to women, a world of survival skills and daydreams. I thought that was about the best little line. talk about the whole job lot there. Where will it all end? So Emeritus Professor Susan Sheridan from Flinders University, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure.
And Kate Darian-Smith, Professor from the University of Melbourne at the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies, thank you to you.
And thank you.